As you know, beloved listeners, I've been giving you constant updates on my pursuit of Godo. Recently, there was the sad night when I appeared at the Opera House and he didn't, but then nor did Sir Ian, the rest of the cast or the audience, because I managed to go on the wrong night. Saw him this week, saw Ian, didn't see Godo, but God, it was great. It was the most exuberant, funniest production. And I've got to tell you, I've seen a lot of them since I saw Barry Humphries in his early 20s.
Well, he must have been funny.
He was hilarious, but he had a costume problem, Ian. Ah, okay. And something dropped out on public display. Anyway, I thought you were all fan-bloody-tastic. But before we talk about that, I had Anthony Gormley on the program a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yes.
And I understand you've made a Godo-like appearance to talk to his wonderful figures.
We were with Waiting for Godo in Perth, and in the same little hotel we were staying in the suburbs, in a sort of Truman Show new development on an old garbage site, which had been cleaned up, there was Anthony Gormley, who I know ever so slightly. And, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? And he explained that east of Perth, in the middle of the desert of Western Australia, he had these 51 figures on the Salt Lake, figures that were based on inhabitants who lived close by, and he recommended a visit, and we managed to organise it on our day off, and it was one of the great days of my life, and it's one of the great artistic installations I've ever seen. It's in my very, very top 10, and it I think changed my life even a little bit.
Well, you wrote very movingly about it.
These figures are... He scanned some local people and then reduced their body mass by a third, so they're spindly creatures. You can identify their gender because he's made that perfectly clear, but there are no facial expressions. They're just these figures standing with their arms out in the mud. And as I went up to one of them, because they're yards and yards and yards apart from each other, I found myself saying, "What are you doing here?" And I'd swear that the statue looked back at me and said, no, what are you doing here? And if an artist makes you question in that way, then it seems to me he's done his job. And it's a wonderful, wonderful experience, and I strongly recommend it.
I must say, he's one of the best guests I've had on the program in decades. He's just such a delightful human as well.
Yes.
Now, what do you do on stage every night is so extraordinary. You and I are exactly the same age. Well,
yes.
You know, give and take the odd hour. And yet you rejoice in the decrepitude. You cavort, you leap, you dance, you do funny things with your hat. Mm. How can you make the bleakest play ever written, although I've always laughed at it, how can you make it such a celebration of life?
I think it's because Sean Mathias, the director, invited his actors to take the characters at their face value. A man comes in and meets his mate, who he hasn't seen since yesterday, and says that he slept the night in a ditch and that he got beaten as usual, and he can't get his boot off because his foot is hurting so much. And the other guy says, "Oh, I've got a problem with my prostate," and they have a laugh about that and they reminisce a little bit. Now, you can take these characters as types. You can treat them as examples of absurdist drama going through their nonsense lives for what existential reason I couldn't explain. Or you can do what Sean invited us to do and say, well, these are real people in a real situation, and there has been a real Holocaust, which has led to this dangerous world where people get beaten at night and even children get beaten, and people don't have enough to eat. And yet somehow, because of the long-standing friendship or partnership or bonhomie, managed to survive. It's a play, therefore, of hope, even though there's a lot of misery. Beckett called it a tragic comedy, and I think that about sums it up.
Mm. Well, for the first time ever, I felt a deep affection for the characters. And
oh, that's good, yeah.
And that's something I don't think Beckett would expect of his audience. I congratulate you on it.
I think Beckett must have been a lover of music hall. You know, Laurel and Hardy, Morecambe and Wise, you know, those double acts that that turn up in all sorts of situations just to entertain an audience and put on their bowler hats, as we're instructed to do in the Beckett play, and exchange patter. A lot of the dialogue is thoroughly going... is theatrical in that way, and my character looks out to into the audience right at the outset and says to his mate, "Charming prospects." What did you say? Charming spot, frightful prospects, or something. Looking at the audience, says, "Let's go." So already that the fourth wall of the theatre is being broken, and the audiences are admitted into the world, and the world is a theatrical one.
The last time you were here, you were Lear,
yes, a
character who feels he's losing control, going mad, and your character in Godot says we're all born mad, some remain so. So you quite like dealing with the fragility of the mind, it would seem.
Well, it's not so much that as that writers like dealing with these themes, and they also like writing about people who've gone off the rails and are perhaps behaving... inappropriately and in a thoroughly unpleasant way. Those do seem to be the best written characters, and therefore I go for those. It's not that I have a predilection to play horrible people or discover the horribleness in myself. It's that on the whole they're the best parts. There are not many wonderful, great, good parts, although Gandalf is one of them, and maybe Uncle Vanya is another, but mostly they're villainous, you know, and most of them have done something absolutely horrible to
himself. The first time I really discovered you was when you were playing James Whale in Gods and Monsters, or Monsters and
Gods. Gods and Monsters, yes.
Yeah, and he was, once again, an immensely attractive and endearing, fragile but thoroughly decent human being.
Yes, well, he did try to be, yes, absolutely. And it was a wonderful part for me to play. And I had a lot of connections with him. He was a man who'd come from the province regions to work in London in the theatre and then went to Hollywood. And he was openly gay, a very unusual thing to be in the 1930s in Hollywood. And he even looked a little bit like my father. So I thought, oh, perhaps I could look a little bit like him. Dyed my hair white, and it was a wonderful part to play, and felt very close to home.
You know, as we talk, it suddenly occurs to me that Whale's image of Frankenstein and yours of Godot have something in common. You know, the same sort of blasted Heath look, the chiaroscuro, and the sympathy for the monstrous.
Yes. Well, is that because Beckett? Everything after Beckett is influenced by him. You know, I think that may be that. I don't think we'd have Harold Pinter's plays in quite the way they occurred if he hadn't been a huge fan of Beckett's. Beckett just seems to have got, particularly in this play, God, Waiting for God, have latched onto a vision of the world that was waiting to be looked at, but which hadn't quite been seen with the clarity of which he understands it. It's something apocalyptic has happened. Well, a Second World War has happened, and he's lived through it, working for the underground in France. He knew what it was like to wait. He would go out with a mate and sit in the forest and wait for a message from another member, unnamed member of the Maquis, to try and unsettle the German occupation. But then the First World War before that, with all those terrible graves across the Somme and Gallipoli and so on. And Beckett sort of cast his baleful but sympathetic eye over the landscape and put it all into a play. And therefore, I think everything since has, whether we know it or not, been affected by his attitude to it. And it's what makes one able to say he was one of the great writers.
You came out at the age of 49, comparatively late, given that the ice of bigotry seemed to have been breaking up. What triggered your decision to do that?
I was living on my own, and I was a free agent, and in the sense that my coming out wouldn't involve a partner who would be defined as being my partner. And I was thinking of coming out, not because it had ever been any inconvenience to me, not to talk about being gay. I'd always been open with my friends and not with my blood family, but with my employers and employees and everybody had known. I just hadn't talked to my family and I hadn't talked to the media about it. An extra bit of coming out journey that people in public life have to go through. But the spur to actually do it was when the the UK government was introducing a nasty law that inhibited what schools could or couldn't teach about homosexuality, and they couldn't teach that gay relationships were on a par with straight relationships, and I took offence at that and said so on BBC radio and came out very easily in an interview much like this one, and the relief, the release, the joy of suddenly being myself at last was... I've never got over it. So it was 14. It took me 49 years, but I do know what it means now to be born again. And best thing I ever did.
Put it on my
gravestone.
Hearing that expression from you, born again, is an astonishing.
Well, yeah. I know what these Christians feel like.
Yeah. Well, while you've been here, you've addressed a gay rights rally in Melbourne, and you've urged our tardy government to sanction same-sex marriage. But, of course, the Pope sees it as being one of the, and I quote, most insidious and dangerous threats facing the world today. Oh. I take it you won't be doing Godo in a Vatican production.
And I'm wondering quite what my public reaction should be to the arrival of the Pope on a state visit to the United Kingdom.
Well, Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins want him arrested at Heathrow, so...
Well, I know. It is a pity that old men of my generation should be so out of touch. I suppose it's inevitable when you declare yourself as a celibate and try to climb to the top of the greasy pole of the politics of the Vatican, then you're not really in touch with the way ordinary people live. And I think that's been the wonderful thing of the last few years, in this country as much as any. And I've just been in South Australia, where they're rightly proud that they helped to begin the revolution legally of repealing old bad laws that the British Empire had left behind. And the Pope's out of touch with that, and many people on the ground are. But, of course, many Catholics disagree with him, and that's the way I prefer to look at it. This is an internal problem for the Catholic Church to deal with. But I don't like it when he makes pronouncements beyond the confines of his flock, and because what he has to say on homosexuality is irrelevant and wrong and cruel often. And its effect on people's lives, and that would go for anybody who shared his views, whether they were Christian or religious or atheist or what.
We've got quite a few openly gay MPs, including a party leader, but I was astonished to be told, and perhaps you can confirm or deny, that you're the first openly gay Brit to be given a gong, a knighthood.
Yeah.
Is that true?
No, I'm not. The first was Angus Wilson, the novelist, and he was openly gay, to his great credit, in the 50s and 60s, and he was knighted, and I think went with his partner to Buckingham Palace to pick it up, and I was the second. There'd been plenty of people who had been knighted, but they hadn't been open about their homosexuality. It's an old card, and
Gielgud, etc.
Terence Rattigan, yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Mm. It was interesting when the closing ceremony of the Gay Games that you took the stage and introduced yourself as Serene, but said the audience could call you Serena. Apparently this was a nickname given to you by Stephen Fry.
Yes, Stephanie Fry. Well, you know, the gay men, but not only gay men in the theatre, have this camp business of calling themselves by girls' names. It's a little bit like Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And I rather resented being called Serena so promptly by the witty Fry, because it has stuck, but I don't mind. I answer to most things, really.
Coming back to the splendid play, which is, to me, largely about, you know, the dying of the light, I wonder how you're dealing, you and I being of the same age, I can ask you this, how you're dealing with with the prospect of personal mortality, as opposed to the way you cavort and
well, I don't
on stage.
Think, I don't think a day goes by without my wondering, is death a day nearer? Because, of course, it is. But when it will come, thank goodness, one doesn't know. It affects me in that a few years ago, I thought I might begin to take things easy, not professionally, not retire, but deliberately keep 6 months to myself to just see friends and do whatever I wanted to do other than work. Apart from missing the stimulus of the work, I also thought, well, hang on, is it sensible at a time when I've still got my faculties? I can still go on the road, I can still get up on the stage, and I can still, my voice is still functioning, not to work, because a time will come, and it may be any day now, when the legs give way, and maybe the mind too, and I can't work. So I won't say I'm rushing to get work in before I can't do it anymore, but this tour is one of the me shaking a fist at
well, it's
death.
Also shaking a leg, and your legs, in fact, are in pretty good shape. Well, that's, you flash them a lot.
Well, that's just genetic, and I can't take any credit for that. So I try and keep myself healthy. Yes, I think one way of doing that is by working, and you know, you and I must read obituaries much more frequently and with much more interest than we used to do. I always note whether the person is older or younger than me and regret it if they're younger. And but it also gives me a very lively concern for the world in which the younger generations are going to have to survive. And so I'm very interested in nuclear weapons and constant wars and all the things that make life miserable for people and dangerous, because it's not fair to bring kids into a world where they're going to have to fight against survival.
Well, in a way, Godot could be seen as post-nuclear,
yes,
in the way that Mad
yes.
Max was. It could also be seen as post-climate change. You know, you can keep moving the metaphor around.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think it's a pity that the Beckett estate, the people who administer the plays, are try and restrict the way in which you do the play. They would like us to just have the set that Beckett described, but he described it for a little cellar theatre where the play was first performed in Paris. We are doing it in quite large theatres across Australia and New Zealand, and it's appropriate there should be a set defining the world in which they live. But it could be any sort of set, and yes, the play could be done in many, many different ways. Originally, Sean Mathias wanted me to do it with Judi Dench playing the other.
Now, but Beckett wouldn't like that person. Because, as
absolutely
you know, he sued a company
for
doing an all-female production, making the point that women, whatever their other virtues, lacked the prostate.
Yes, indeed. And it's odd that this play should have as its two principal characters two old men, but they don't seem to be dirty old men. There are very few references to sex and none to specific girls or women who are wives or partners that they've had. They seem to manage to survive without them, and yet I don't think there's much homoeroticism going on. So it's very unusual in that way that he's managed to sort of remove sex entirely.
Well, it's one of the best nights I've ever had in the theatre, but it made me marvel yet again at how you fellas remember all that stuff. I mean, that endless soliloquy of Lucky. So, I mean, how do you do that?
Well, Brendan O'Hay would be able to answer that. I think he just diligently had to sit down at home and do what actors often do and just bring his hand down the page, revealing the next sentence and see that it had lodged in his mind. But there is I can tell you, listening to it night after night, there is a logic to it. And the minute his character is asked to speak, think out loud, he does. And the first thing he says is to question whether there is or is not a God. Well, that is understandable coming out of the mouth of a man who's got his neck in a noose, to wonder that. So there are throughout the speech milestones that he can, that Brendan can hold on to. But yes, no, I wonder with you how he's done it. And
well, how all of you do it, and of course no one can actually give you a prompt with that sort of intimacy. I got an email yesterday and from a Melbourne playwright married to a very well-known actor, and he's written a homage to Beckett, a sequel where Godot turns up. He sent me the play. I haven't read it yet, but I think it's probably heretical. Look, it's marvellous to talk to you. You're going off to New Zealand.
Next week we're in Sydney, then we go to Wellington, and then we come back to Sydney, because by popular demand, I can happily say, and then we go to Christchurch, and then, you'll be interested, we're going to go to Cape Town. The football will all have ended, and we're going to play without our set, if you can imagine it, just the actors and their costumes. We're going to play in the Fougard Theatre, named for Athol Fougard, in the centre of Cape Town, and small theatre. And then probably our last performance of Beckett will be, not there, but in Kailicha Township, in the gymnasium, to an audience of 800 locals sitting on bleachers. And we're warned that as they've never seen a play before, they might choose to not only talk to each other during it, but try and talk to the actors, and it should be very entertaining. And someone said, why on earth are you going to do Waiting for Godot in a township? I said, well, I think when lucky comes on the end of a rope, that might be a metaphor that people in South Africa will understand.
Well, he's proving as elusive as the Messiah, and, and we wait for Godot and for the Second Coming, but I'm glad I witnessed your Second Coming here, Ian.
Oh, thank you very, very much.
It was
much.
A wonderful night, and congratulations yet again.
Thank you very much.
On our next, we'll be looking at the troubles in the Central Asian Republic of Kyrgyzstan, and I'll be talking to biological anthropologist Richard Wrangham about how cooking got us cooking. He reckons it made us human. And let's check the news now on ABC Radio National to see if there's any hot flash about Godot.